Why did you think The Who would make a good case study in rock and roll?
Well, it seemed to me that they'd been through everything, and not at such a high level as the Beatles or Rolling Stones, where the experience becomes exaggerated to the point where it's not typical of anything. They went through instrument destruction, pop art, festivals, rock opera, drugs, everything I could possibly think of, mod, hippie, Monterey, Woodstock, movies. And it was just, it was an opportunity to see how a fairly typical group of people were affected by the process of rock stardom. And really to see that process in action over a long period of time, 20 years, and to see the consequences of it, which may have been a little more than I bargained for by the time I finished the job.
Did you choose them because they were musically important as well?
Oh, they were clearly musically important. I mean, when I say instrument destruction and feedback and things like that, those are essential parts of modern music making, not only in rock, but I think in certain kinds of other music too. And The Who really pioneered some of that. Also, I think that Keith Moon was an extraordinary drummer, not in any conventional timekeeping way, but in terms of power and in terms of his just ability to create certain kinds of effects. Townsend's a clearly a very inventive guitarist and a composer of some stature among rock people, at least. So it just completely made sense to me that on every level to tell that story.
When they were first forming, Peter Townsend was in art school and Roger Daltrey was a laborer, and you said that discrepancy helped form the group's persona. And in what way?
Well, I think that, first of all, remember that these are English people, where class distinctions are drawn both broadly and finely. And it wasn't just that Pete was an art student. Pete was an art student whose father had been a dance band musician, that is, like swing kind of dance bands. Roger wasn't just a sheet metal worker. Roger's father had gone to work for Armitage Shanks, which makes all the sort of urinals and porcelain toilet receptacles in England, at 14 as an office boy, and kind of worked his way up, but not very high. So it was the classic kind of class battle. But rock and roll being a music with very deep working class roots, Townsend couldn't use his own voice. Daltrey coming from basically no intellectual tradition at all, because in that sense the English working class is as impoverished as our own in terms of having any kind of articulate culture until rock and roll. So what happened was basically Pete became the instrument that gave Roger his voice, and Roger became the voice of Townsend's songs. But that didn't make either one of them happy. That made both of them incredibly frustrated, because Roger always thought Pete had it too easy, and Roger, I think, always struck Pete as being far too vulgar to be the true representation of Pete Townsend's goals.
Their first image was as mods. What did it mean to be a mod when they started to play, both visually and what it was supposed to represent to people?
Well, what it meant when they started to play is a lot different than what it meant by the time they were finished playing, or certainly what it means now. Mod developed out of some East End lowlife, semi-gangster types who wore very elaborately tailored suits, very stylishly cut hair, every detail precise, specific brands and styles of shirts, socks, shoes, everything. And as they were called modernists. And as modernist style traveled across London from the East End to the western suburbs, where like Shepherd's Bush and Ealing and Acton, where The Who were from, it essentially became, the name became shortened to mod. Younger people who were slightly, but I mean only slightly, more innocent picked up on it. Sort of people who weren't really into anything heavy but weren't above knocking some goods off the back of a truck from time to time to get the clothing they needed. People who had jobs, but they were maybe like on the side, up to a little bit of no good. And that became Maude. That was the first wave of Maude. Fairly hard characters. And Maude was the first British style cult in of them all, and everything that's followed since then, up to the current New Romantics, as they call themselves. I guess that's the most recent one that I can think of, anyway. That there was glitter and there was hippie and there was everything in Britain can be subsumed, in British popular culture, rather, can be subsumed under one style cult or another. What was different about Maude was that it was explicitly and angrily working class. Yet at the same time, there was no political dimension to it whatsoever. What was important to be a Maude, you had to be working because you had to be affluent. And you had to be disciplined. And you had to be incredibly perceptive about the slightest shadings of detail. Style details changed every week. It wasn't a matter of Fred Perry was a maker of knit shirts like Lacoste is today. You had to have a Fred Perry shirt, but maybe one week it would be right to have a Fred Perry shirt with a stripe across the chest. The next week it might be totally wrong to have that stripe across the chest, and you better not turn up wearing it. So there are actually cases of Maudes who spent an entire weekend indoors, as it were, so that they wouldn't be placed in the position of going out looking not right. That's how important it was to look right. As for music, Maude, until The Who, didn't have its own music. They danced to imported Motown records. And that's very important because the whole importation of goods from the United States was a big thing. Maudes were kind of surrogate Americans. And we'll, if you meet people who were Maudes in the 60s, will describe themselves to you that way. And also to Jamaican and West Indian bluebeat and ska, what became reggae. But this is a little earlier than the beginning of reggae. So there's music, there were pills. People took amphetamines so that they could stay up all night because the idea was to work. You had to work all week to have the money. Then after work, you would go to the tailor shop and make you a little payment on your tailored suit or get whatever haberdashery you needed. And finally, you would go out. You would go out Friday night. You would stay up all night. And that's where the pills came in. And then Saturday night, same thing. Now, if this sounds like it's all male, that's because it was, to a great extent, all male at that time. This is 1962, 3, 4 we're talking about. Towards the spring of 1964, a group of Maudes on their Vespa scooters wearing their anorak parkas, which is sort of semi-military parkas, went to Brighton at the seashore for the bank holiday that's in May, kind of Easter time rather, it was in April. And there they encountered rockers, which are just basically leather motorcycle Marlon Brando and the Wild One kind of lookalikes. And they had some very minor altercations, which in Britain, which was even more staid then than it is now, were headline-making. That someone actually busted a couple of beach chairs and broke a couple of plate glass windows and people were jostling each other in the streets was headline-making. And Maude then became a craze throughout Britain. And at that point, The Who kind of stepped in because they were the one band on the fringes of that scene that kind of had the look down, kind of had the attitude in their lyrics, and the sound of their music was considered to be kind of disruptive and noisy enough to adequately represent Maude emotion. And then Maude got translated into more T-shirts and jeans and simpler things that provincial kids could pick up on. And there developed kind of a class system within Maude between the so-called ace faces at the top and what were called tickets in the lower rungs, just the ordinary kind of kids.
So to their listeners, they became a symbol of Maude.
Yeah. This whole sociology lesson proceeds to be the one of the absolute keys to The Who's career because it gave them a very... Their kind of status as flag bearers of that gave them a very intimate relationship with their audience in Britain, which, of course, as they got bigger and bigger, they proceeded to lose and attempt to regain. And a great deal of the story is about them trying to recapture that, I think. Another part of the story is that Maude was because it was surrogate Americanism, I guess, was the one style cult, important style cult at least, in the last 20 years in Britain that didn't catch on in the States. And so when the Who came to America, it took them much longer to break through than, say, the Rolling Stones, the Beatles, or the Animals, or any of the other groups that are more or less their peers. So it all devolves down into the rock opera Quadrophenia, I guess. But also to the idea that rock stands for a certain style of living your life and a certain principle that's behind that style. Mod may very well be the first style cult that was meant to reflect some kind of lifestyle philosophy.
That was apolitical.
Oh, absolutely apolitical. I think basically all lifestyle philosophy is probably apolitical. Mod was, because it had a clear understanding, as only British working class people can, of its working class origins, was consciously apolitical in a way that most of the other style cults aren't.
Rock critic Dave Marsh is my guest, if you're just joining us. And right now we're discussing the subject of his new book, Before I Get Old, The Story of the Who, which has just been published by the St. Martin's Press. There are a lot of interesting things in the packaging of rock stars that you talk about in the book. And this didn't just apply to the Who, but Roger Daltrey was just getting married towards the beginning of the formation of the band, and he wasn't supposed to be out about that. It wasn't really acceptable
Nobody
for rock
was supposed
star
to
be
married.
Married.
And, well, there are two things, one of which is he wasn't supposed to be married, and the other of which was that his manager happened to be gay, didn't want him to be married. That was a whole separate conflict, which I don't really go into in the book because I didn't know exactly how to do it. It's easier for me to talk about that than it is to write about it because it's so complicated. And also because certain things about Kit Lambert, who was the manager, his life have become apparent since then that weren't then. That was another part of the conflict. But the biggest thing was that you weren't supposed to do that.
Yeah, why
you know,
not?
Rock stars were supposed to be objects of desire for young women, basically for teenage girls, and even almost pre-teenage girls. And there still is, to a great extent, that attitude about pop stars in England in a way that's kind of almost died out in the States, I think. That isn't the only aspect of packaging. In other words, Pete Townsend had to be very careful about letting it out. He'd gone to art school, but it was you weren't supposed to be too smart. You weren't supposed to be too adventurous. You were supposed to kind of play by the rules and then break them every once in a while in a way that everybody would get and kind of nudge way. It's a confusing and fascinating thing exactly why people allow themselves to be tinkered with in that way. And I mean, this was with the Who, right down to the socks and shoes and shoelaces that one wore, because they had to capitalize on that mod image, which, of course, if you think that the pop star is only going to have a career lifespan of about 2 years, it's not a big deal. If it, in fact, however, turns out that it's 20 years, what you've done is you've created and perpetuated a massive identity crisis that's very difficult to recover from. You've also encouraged people to acquire certain habits that are regarded in every other aspect of life as antisocial, like lying about basic human facts. And all that takes its toll, which is really, I think, to a great extent, what the sadder portions of this book are about.
The image creation that you described sounds not unlike the Hollywood studios, but there it was easy to tell who the packagers were because you had whole parts of the studio devoted to imagery and public relations
well,
and stills. Who did it in rock and roll? Who, especially at the time when the Who were coming up, who were the official image packagers?
There were publicists and there were managers and there were the music papers. There are three or four music weeklies in Britain that are kind of in that Fleet Street, I hate the facts mode, you know, the real Rupert Murdoch stuff, which is the essence of English press. It's not like some weird corner of the English press. That is the English press. There were radio stations. There were everything that there is now. I think the difference really is between Hollywood image making and the packaging of rock stars is that no one expected even James Stewart, much less Ronald Reagan, to walk it like he talked it. And people took rock stars to be not just kind of generational symbols, but to be what they were, to be what they said they were. The emotional conviction that's expected in the music is expected to carry through into their offstage life. And that may be the biggest piece of image mongering of all, but nonetheless, it creates incredible problems when you don't live up to it. And not only for the people who are being, one could argue, hoodwinked by it. I don't think people are necessarily being hoodwinked by it, because in many cases, what's being sold is a level of idealism and self-respect for people from that working class, allegedly culturalist group of people that they can't get anywhere else. And I think that the hard part is for the performers who just feel real guilty about having lied. I think the public may be, in fact, very well served in some ways by that particular kind of image making, rather than the kind of image making we get now where it's like, don't pay any attention to that. I'm just decadent, and you haven't any right to expect me to have any social obligations whatsoever. The kind of Mick Jagger thing of today. You know, I can eat dinner with the Shah of Iran if I want to.
You mentioned that one of the consequences of that kind of image making, when listeners really believe it, is that it causes an identity crisis for the people who have been passing it off as their real life. What are the manifestations of that identity crisis amongst the people in The Who?
Well, I think a couple of things. One of the things that you're encouraged to do is the whole cult of youth. And that's not just a matter of looking young and not aging past, say, 35. That's a matter of not aging past 20. That's a matter of staying a teenager. And again, it's being expected to walk it like you talk it, which means continuing to act like a teenager. The reality is that you can't. And if you continue to take drugs, stay up all night, and do all the things that you can maybe get away with for a year or two when you're 18, 19, 20 years old, either you're going to end up like Keith Moon and you're going to die of it, which is exactly what happened to him, or you're going to end up like Pete Townsend. You're going to be so messed up that you have a very, very difficult time having any kind of mature relationship, and that's going to send you back into a spiral of depression and probably drug dependency, meaning could be cigarettes, could be coffee, could be anything, but you're going to be dependent on a number of things because you're not really 19 anymore, and you can't do it naturally. You're going to have to do it with some artificial stimulation.
You can see people who end up like that, victims of their own self-destruction or victims of outside manipulators like image creators, the record industry, journalism, things like that. Which do you see them fitting into?
I'm not sure I understand that question.
Well, do you think that the kinds of problems that you're talking about are because of self-destructive tendencies, things that come from within, or because of problems that come from without, from the things that you're pushed into doing to stay a star?
I think the inevitable answer to that is that everybody has some self-destructive tendencies, and everybody is in the final analysis responsible for their own life. However, there are processes that get set at work that tend to bring out the worst in a person. And in fact, it isn't so much that they're designed to, but they're quite callous about what those kind of consequences might be. It would be a mistake to say, well, it was the press's fault, or it was the manager's fault. The idea isn't to lay blame. The idea is to work out, how does this happen? And it happens, you know, little by little. It's like they're chipping away, as that old song says, at whatever is decent and humane about you. And the other thing you get into is when you start to get well-known, you immediately become isolated. Especially back then when it was, you know, tear their hair off, you know, scream your lungs out kind of time. Those bands of the 60s really got isolated from their fans and pulled away. It was like, oh, don't get too close to them. They might hurt you. Now, that happened a lot less to The Who than it did to the Rolling Stones or the Beatles. I mean, if you talk to the Rolling Stones or the Beatles, the idea they have of their audience, even today, is so distant and so much of Brian Epstein's fantasy and so little of reality. Despite John Lennon, that's still true. And even for The Who and some of the bands like that, The Who probably stayed better in touch, You know, I mean, if a kid walks up to Pete Townsend on the street and wants to talk to him, Pete will probably stop and talk to him at the risk of being of having the bank shut its window on him and not having any money for the weekend. Out of generosity, guilt, or both, I can't really say.
Rock critic Dave Marsh is my guest, and we're discussing the subject of his new book, Before I Get Old, The Story of the Who. Pete Townsend developed a very demonstrative style. Can you describe that style for our listeners and tell us how he started to develop it?
Well, for those who never saw it, he saw, actually, I guess the best way is to describe the evolution of the two principal gimmicks that he had, which was one was windmilling his arm, which he saw Keith Richard of the Rolling Stones do one night in a little club and thought it was a good idea, and he just took it and exaggerated it. And it really involves bringing his arm up over his head and coming down and slashing the chords as hard as he can and then just whipping the arm back around and doing that in kind of a windmill motion. And the other, well, then there are knee splits, knee drops, duck walking, all kinds of things like that. And the leading up to, in the old days, the rather astonishing finale of seeing him take his guitar, batter it on the stage, run the amplifiers over, knock them over, jump up and down on them, play feedback, all of which developed quite by accident. First, the feedback when they were playing on small stages and he would set his amplifier up on a chair, would feed back against the microphone, because an electric guitar is a guitar with a microphone underneath the strings. And the microphone underneath the strings and the vocal mic would get into each other and they would start to feed back through the amplifier. The other thing that, and so he started, and he began to learn how to manipulate that feedback, get certain frequencies and notes and tones out of it, and actually play the feedback. While doing that one night, which involved very exaggerated motions with the guitar itself, he was playing on a stage with a low ceiling, and he put the neck of the guitar through the ceiling and broke it. And he was so angry as he watched his art school chum sneering at him, he says, that he just began to bash the guitar and finish the job. And it caught on, and they had to do it. And that became really the centerpiece of the Who's style, because then Keith Moon, the drummer, who never liked to be upstaged, began to smash up his drum kit. And Roger Daltrey began to bash his microphones around. Well, the problem with that was not, I mean, there was a good thing about that, which was that it represented a real lack of respect for property. The bad part of it was very expensive at a time when the band was making very little money. Pete would be maybe breaking $200 guitars on nights when they were only making $300 or $350. And after expenses, they were making less than zero. So anyway, that's the evolution of his rather demonstrative style. And the resolution of his rather demonstrative style was that they went several hundred thousand pounds in debt until he wrote Tommy, which was not only the group's first hit, but the first time they ever had anything that allowed them to stop smashing up equipment.
Do you think they enjoyed doing it?
From time to time, if they were frustrated enough or angry enough or just generally, you know, had that attitude that night. But I think basically, no, I think it was a chore.
Yeah, it's interesting when something that becomes a kind of sudden expression ends up being ritualized and you have to do it every night. Do you think that they ever started to, resent being held to doing that, that they had to do it?
Yeah, well, I think that's one reason why they began to look around and see, well, what else can we do to get ourselves out of this gimmick? In other words, it was one thing for the Beatles to all have the gimmick of collarless jackets and not that hard to change it. It was another thing to have this thing, which was a real albatross, for one thing because it's very hard to top it. What do you come up with to top this to keep people interested?
What do you think it caught on so well with the fans?
Well, because I think it did reflect indeed a deep lack of respect for property in both Britain and America, which are societies that have far too much respect for property and not nearly enough for human emotion. And the destruction was definitely a lack of respect for property coming out of complete, almost existential anger and frustration. So I think that was the basic reason. The other thing is, on a just much more superficial level, is there's a kind of gee whiz, I wish I could do that kind of envy that it inspired. You know, and there's and also they were playing to adolescents who tend to value rather more strongly than the rest of us grandiose displays of energy, emotion, whatever.
What are some of the excesses you think that that spawned by other rock groups?
Well, there actually got to the point at one point in the 60s where there was a group called The Move that would demolish TV sets on stage. The difference being that demolishing a TV set is like a concept art statement, but it isn't really integral to a rock band's performance. Demolishing your guitar is a real statement. That's like a writer beating up his typewriter or a painter, you know, smashing his easel. It's now got to the point where there's a group called the Plasmatics, kind of allegedly a punk group, more like a sexual exploitation show, who blow up automobiles and stuff on stage. I've never actually seen them do this, but I've read more than I want to about them, which is directly in line from that. And that is excessive, you know. And the reason it's excessive is not because there's any somehow the Who won a battle and there's not still too much respect for property in the society, but almost because it's come out the other end now, and it's like the guitar, or rather the car, the automobile that they're blowing up, is actually a statement of how important the automobile really is, rather than being a statement of this music is bigger than that guitar. It's now a statement of this car is really important. Watch what we're going to do with it just because we want to. It's like nyeh, nyeh, nyeh kind of stuff.
Look how much money we have, we can afford to destroy it.
Yeah, which is funny because I don't think the Plasmatics actually have that much money. That they probably can't. But I think the net effect of it is a rather jaded and decadent response.
Something else that earned them the Who the reputation of being jaded and decadent was their reputation with drugs and being amongst the first people to actually talk to the press about doing drugs.
Which is strange because at least one person in the band, Roger, took very, very few drugs. Again, pills were real important to the Mods, and all of them at different points took pills. Roger stopped very early because of his throat. He simply couldn't sing two nights in running if he took pills or drank. So Roger did almost nothing. Also, Pete smoked a lot of pot because he was an art school student, and everyone did back then, or I'm sure not everyone, but it seemed that way. Keith Moon was just a garbage pail, would do anything. John Entwistle was quiet about what he did. But I think The Who maybe were more of a drinking band than a drug band. What happened was, though, that Pete was so garrulous, so desperate for any kind of attention, and so basically, in a funny way, honest to a fault, that as soon as the subject came up, he went, yeah, I take that. Just like almost matter-of-factly. And then after he saw what happened, then very calculatingly, knowing that it would help to make him notorious, which it did. And you know, what's unusual about that, I think, is primarily the fact that many people who had far more indulgent drug habits got booked for it a lot less. But then, you know, look what happened to the Beatles, who don't strike me, at least, as being a particularly druggy act compared to some of the cocaine acts and heroin addicts that we've seen.
When punk started becoming popular in England, what was the relationship of the punk performers to The Who and vice versa?
Well, the sound of the punk bands originally was very, very close to the first two or three Who singles. I Can't Explain, My Generation, Anyway, Anyhow, Anywhere, maybe Substitute. Very stripped down, a lot of guitar, muddy but booming bass, rudimentary chords, primitive beat. Primitive to the extent that there is no actual beat coming out of the drums. It's just a lot of percussion effects, a big wash of cymbals, and the beats may be carried in the bass if there is one at all. Very forced. And that was a direct, in Britain, some of the British bands got that direct, and then there was another thing that happened, which was The Who were tremendously influential on American bands like the MC5, specifically. The MC5 were a tremendous influence on the New York Dolls, and New York Dolls were a tremendous influence on the Ramones, and the Ramones went to Britain and kicked off the whole punk thing. Also, I think Malcolm McLaren, who was the Svengali behind the Sex Pistols spent quite a bit of time talking to Chris Stamp, who was the other one of the Who's managers, and used a lot of his or of the Who's early marketing technique in terms of shock effect.
Although you could maybe hear the influence of the Who in punk music, did the Who come to symbolize at that point some of the music and excess that punk was reacting against?
Well, I think to one degree or another, I mean, that's true and it's false. In other words, most of the punk musicians themselves were very careful to say, we hate all those old rock bands, but not so much the Who. Like, the Sex Pistols, with the exception of Johnny Rotten, turned out to be big Who fans. Knew exactly where they were coming from. Because the Who had kind of held out against a great many of the more frivolous and you know, disgusting excesses of rock's Baroque period, if you can talk about something 30 years old being Baroque, or having periods for that matter. But there was another aspect of it that was very much a criticism of exactly groups like The Who, both because there's a rather shallow critique, which is rock bands shouldn't have careers, they shouldn't stick around so long, they should just get off and make way for younger bands, which in my not very humble opinion is nonsense, because you don't develop an art form, a society, or anything else if you just start discarding people after 18 months. There was a deeper critique, which is that these bands have been paying a lot of lip service to ideals that they're not living up to, which was, I think, felt by everyone in The Who and by a lot of Who fans as being absolutely correct, that the process had finally caught up with The Who and they were kind of going through the motion. And I think it caught them up short, although they were never able to really effectively deal with it, I don't think.
Well, they became in the position of being a lot older than a good deal of their fans and a lot older than the rock groups who were coming up. And the quote from my generation was always thrown back at them, "Hope I die before I get old." How seriously, literally, did anyone ever intend that to be?
Well, to the extent that it was ever said seriously, as I have said before, it's the stupidest line ever written. It's hard to tell. One thing Pete says in the book is a quote I found was that he says, "Oh, he'd like to get on TV and wrap dynamite around his head and blow it all up after they've had two hit singles." But really, that's him talking really art school rhetoric, I think. But there was another aspect of it, and the reason I called, I don't think they meant "Hope I Die," but the reason I called the book "Before I Get Old" is because I really do think that they felt that there was like a time limit in which they had to achieve everything they were ever going to achieve. And I think that's one of the worst parts of the whole pop music process, which is the sense that you're going to be outmoded soon, which is something a lot of people in this society go through. And I think tremendous numbers of workers are going through it now as they feel like, oh, you know, I've had it because, you know, they're going to bring in the computers and they're not going to need me anymore, which is probably true. That doesn't, you know, and there's no place to put that human energy after that. That's, you're just finished, you're washed up, and you're discarded. And I think The Who felt that part very, very seriously, that they had to get it done before they got old.
Do you think that groups end up sometimes becoming everything that they were reacting against when they started, what with the wealth and excesses that they become heir to when they become really successful?
I think anybody who's seen The Big Chill will understand exactly how this happens, not just to pop groups, but to all kinds of people become what they set out not to be. In fact, I would even go so far as to say anybody who's ever been a parent will understand some of that. On the other hand, I am not so cynical as Lawrence Kasdan. I don't think that everybody becomes what they set out not to be. And I don't really think that The Who, for everything that they've done that failed, were wrong to try. And I don't think that they didn't accomplish anything. That's like the people who say that the Vietnam War movement, anti-war movement, did not succeed. It's not true. We got out of the thing and we got out faster. you know, and that's important, that they tried to do that, and that they paved the way for the next people to take it to the next step.
We're not talking about the things that they become heir to when they're successful. I think I meant showbiz. They're also showbiz.
Well, that's it. It's that whole shallow thing of, like, entertainment, which, you know, I've always hated the concept of entertainment because I've always thought that I was quite adequate to entertain myself, and I wasn't about to pay someone else to do it for me. But if somebody wanted to offer me art that was stimulating on whatever level and had some relevance to my life, then I was for that. And I think to the extent that the Who lost the connection between their entertaining work as art and as work and became just like fodder for the masses, I think, you know, is a very deep betrayal of what they wanted and what they set out for.
Rock critic Dave Marsh is my guest, and he's just written a new book called Before I Get Old, The Story of the Who, and it's published by the St. Martin's Press. He's a founding editor of Cream magazine, wrote for Rolling Stone for many years, did a column there, and has written other books, including a bestseller about Bruce Springsteen. One of his current projects is an 8-page newsletter published out of his living room, which is called Rock and Roll Confidential, and in it you could read a lot of the kinds of stories and information that music magazines aren't apt to publish. And Dave, why did you start doing Rock and Roll Confidential? You've had like all the successful journalist positions in nearly all of the rock magazines. Why do a mimeographed 8-page newsletter from your living room?
I think that's why. I think you reach a certain point where you have acquired a certain responsibility. You've acquired an audience. You've seen what happens to performers and journalists who don't take that responsibility seriously, and it's just time to make a move. I also felt that the political climate and the economic climate in the United States, as it pertained to a lot of people I care about, was desperate, and it was time for somebody to try to reconnect popular culture, particularly musical culture, to political and social thought and activity.
To what extent can you do that in the rock press, and how much do the advertisers in the rock magazines determine what can and can't be said?
Well, I think the question is, what extent can you do it in any part of the press? I think the rock press is probably a little more frivolous because it's dealing with a little more frivolous subject. But when you see people printing, you know, unmitigated nonsense from Korean Airlines about what really happened over there, it's not any worse than seeing, or certainly not any shallower or flimsier than seeing somebody print unmitigated nonsense about David Bowie. In fact, it might be a little better to do it about David Bowie. So I think it's the same problem, and I think that advertising, which and the whole concept of corporate involvement, is ultimately one of the major reasons why that problem exists. If you go too far with your critique, then you're into a situation of like, well, then why would you want to try to be selling people a can of Pepsi? Or why would Pepsi want to help you out? And the reality is that Pepsi isn't going to want to. Warner Brothers Records isn't going to want to. CBS News isn't going to want to. Neither is anybody else. So you come to a point where you simply say, okay, well, I'll do this another way. I don't need you. And in fact, you would be an active hindrance to what I'd like to accomplish.
One of the trends that you've been trying to monitor and analyze is the way corporations are swallowing up record companies and record company conglomerates. How many big record companies are there now? And can you give us an idea of like the structure of the record industry?
There are five right now. Record industry has moved into a very, very concentrated position to the point where if you survey Billboard's Hot 100 chart, you find that I would say substantially more than 90%, like 98, 99, possibly 100% in many weeks of the Hot 100 will be records that are released by either the CBS Group, the Warner Electro Atlantic Group, which is Warner Communications, MCA, RCA, or Capital EMI. Or PolyGram is the other one, I guess. So there's five or six. I lost track. I thought it was five. Anyway, What's especially scary to me about that in terms of rock music is that this isn't the first time that that's happened. In fact, up through the dawn of rock and roll, the Hot 100 was dominated by the Decca Group, which is now MCA, the Capitol Group, which was bought out by the British corporation EMI, CBS, and RCA, and that was it. And that meant that only certain very specific kinds of music got recorded, which represented basically people, white middle-class people in the northeastern United States. The rise of rock and roll was accompanied by, or caused by, depending on how you want to look at it, an enormous insurgence of labels from the South, the West, the Middle West, black people, other ethnic people, mostly working with black music or with Southern music, so that you had King Records out of Cincinnati, you had Sun Records in Memphis, you had Motown in Detroit, VJ Records in Chicago, you had Modern Records in Los Angeles, Duke Records in Houston, and the thing became decentralized, and it became very open. Since about 1967 or 8, when the Warner Group began to form under highly dubious circumstances, out of parking lots and limousine and funeral home companies, that the concentration has become, it's a period of enormous contraction has taken place. For the first 10 years, that was accompanied by massive growth in the size of the market between the advent of Elvis and, say, the Saturday Night Fever soundtrack. You saw a growth from something like $250 million to the neighborhood of $4 billion. In the year after Saturday Night Fever, you saw a 50% contraction back down to about $2 billion gross in 1983 dollars, which was probably almost back down to the pre-Elvis level. One of the reasons is because, once again, fewer kinds and types of music and people are being represented. And that's a direct result of the corporate concentration.
So you think music is becoming more homogenous?
There's no question about it. And I don't mean by that that some of the international transference of style that's been going on isn't a very good and healthy thing. But to the extent that it's controlled by multinational conglomerates, it's a bad thing.
We're also in a period where radio and rock video is pretty segregated. What do you see as the forces behind that?
Well, I think it's the same. I think it's the same thing. I think the radio thing is the most dangerous of all for a couple different reasons. One of which is that when people deal with the radio, in my opinion, and under the law, no matter what the FCC decides to enforce, radio waves do not belong to people who happen to have broadcasting licenses. They belong to the citizens of the United States. And you don't have a right to exclude people on the grounds of race or rhythmic accent from your radio station. You just don't have that right. I challenge someone to prove that they do. You know, I mean, if I had slightly less on my plate, I'd be very tempted to file a lawsuit on exactly those grounds somewhere. But secondly, I think that with some of the album-oriented FM rock stations, which are lily white, all male formats, the word demographics has become a code word for a secret agenda on the part of the radio programmers, which is designed to literally culturally segregate this country and get it back to normal. I don't think that people like Lee Abrams and Rick Carroll and Jeff Pollock are substantially different than people like James Watt in terms of the vision that they have of who really ought to be running the show.
You're saying in Rock and Roll Confidential and with the kind of writing that you're doing that rock should be viewed as politically as any other aspect of labor or work in manufacturing.
I don't understand
in
how
America.
Anybody could ever look at anything that comes out of, first of all, I don't see how you can look at anything in a completely apolitical fashion. I mean, that's what my politics are, is that everything is political. For better, I mean, that can make your life, you know, that can make ordering dinner a complicated matter sometimes. And you got to know where to draw a certain line just in order to get through the day. On the other hand, to draw that line, you know, again, you come back to this entertainment bugaboo. To draw it at rock and roll is really stupid because rock and roll came out of an incredible racial and social controversy. I mean, it's no accident that Elvis Presley popped up less than 6 months after Brown versus Board of Education. Alan Freed got famous as a disc jockey for playing black records to white listeners and getting people upset over his race mixing. That's what rock and roll is all about, folks.
Why do you think rock is so behind in sexual politics? I'd even use the word regressive.
Well, first of all, I'm not sure that that's entirely true. And it's certainly much less true now than it used to be. You do now have a substantial number of female performers, from Tina Weymouth and the Talking Heads, Donna Summer, Annie Lennox from Eurythmics. They're all female bands. There are a tremendous number of women who are changing that. And I don't think that's tokenism. I think that's a real substantial change. Feminism has had a tremendous impact on pop music. And in fact, in England, I would say that one of the few places in that society where feminism has had any impact. On the other hand, there are still vast areas of rock and roll that are regressive. Partly that's because rock and roll in the United States is made by industrial area working class people, which is precisely the place where feminism has not penetrated as an idea, which is partly the fault of rock and roll for not paying attention to the society it lives in, partly the fault of the mass feminist organizations for not paying attention to that group of people. It's also true that rock and roll has, by unfortunate tradition, been male-dominated in the States especially in genres like heavy metal, and especially by adolescent males who tend to have very stupid and juvenile and sexist attitudes about women. So I think it's explicable. I think it's changing. I think it has to change a lot more. Some of those people give me a lot of hope that it will change without getting into a factionalized thing of women's music. Just like I think that we can reintegrate pop music without getting into a thing of just black music for black people. Because that's that whole separate but equal thing that the segregationists always want. And it'll never be equal as long as it's separate. That's really the real politics, I think, of Rock and Roll Confidential, is just that statement. It'll never be equal as long as it's separate. This is the reason that we say, in a similar sense, which really shocks people, that we think it's wrong for classical music to have government funding if other forms of American popular expression don't. And it is wrong, because it'll never be equal as long as it's separate. It's as simple as that. If you keep that in mind, then there's never any doubt in your mind that women have to have the same opportunity to speak out as men, that black people do, as white people, that Oriental people do, as everybody else, that gay people do, that, you know, that everybody does. And that you've got to protect that, and you've got to not just talk about it. You've got to do things to advance those ideas.
Rock and roll started off as dance music, and it's been traditionally the beat that gets you before the lyrics. But I think when you find a lyric offensive, either for reasons of misogyny or whatever the reason it offends you, you kind of have to pause, and this very self-conscious process takes over. You start asking yourself, gee, can you actually dance to this lyric? Can you enjoy this lyric? How much does a really offensive lyric prevent you from enjoying music if the remainder of the music is appealing to you?
Probably less than it should for the good of my political rectitude. I still love Brown Sugar by the Rolling Stones every time I hear it. I just try not to think about it. But I think another thing about it is that in the kind of spontaneous process by which pop culture works, creating that self-consciousness and making you stop dancing and start thinking isn't a bad thing. I think that one of the reasons for the resurgent involvement of women in pop music, because they weren't always squeezed out of it. I mean, you got people like Big Maybelle and Aretha Franklin, and, you know, there is a tradition, although it's largely a black tradition. Nevertheless, you know, one of the reasons why that came about was because there were a lot of women who were attuned to feminist values to one degree or another, and who did, in fact, have that moment of stopping and saying, this ain't right. And their response, totally correct political and artistic response, was, well, I will solve that problem by going out and doing this music right, my way. So I think, I mean, that's, I wouldn't want to carry that analogy too far, because you do actually get into the point where you can actually speciously prove that segregation caused the civil rights movement, or you know, was a good thing for the civil rights movement by carrying that kind of logic too far. But I think to an extent, that's the right response. And there's nothing wrong about being self-conscious about your encounters with popular culture, just like you are. I mean, certainly if I read Norman Mailer, who happens to be a writer who in many instances I like, and I see him, you know, walk once more into the yawning bear trap of his sexism, it makes me sit back, put the book down, and start thinking about, well, how can we avoid making these mistakes again?
What kind of bands are you listening to now and enjoying?
I listen to everything.
I guess I meant enjoying.
I listen to and enjoy every kind of music.
Uh-huh.
And I think that's another part of Rock and Roll Confidential. Everything else, or too many rock publications, too many radio stations, are devolving the same way that too many radio stations are, where it's like only hardcore punk music is good, or only funk is good, or only singer-songwriters are good. When I say I listen to everything with enjoyment, I do. I mean, I have never liked anything that Group X from Los Angeles has done. I heard the first song on their new record yesterday, which I wish I could remember the title of. Thought it was great. Didn't very much like the rest of the record, but that was great. My favorite new album in the last 2 weeks is Ricky Skaggs, which is a country record, a hardcore country record. On the other hand, I've been listening to a lot of gospel music from the 50s over the last year or so that I found to be one of the most rewarding and sustaining experiences of my life, and I am by no means an evangelical Christian, much less a black Pentecostal, which is what all those people are. So I think that there's treasure wherever you seek to dig if you're willing to do the work. You hear a lot of bad music to get to the good stuff, though.
In Rock and Roll Confidential, you criticize a lot of the rock industry on nearly every level. And rock and roll, which started as a very direct, populist kind of music, is now owned so much by the rock industry. How does the music continue to mean so much to you when you're so critical of what the industry has become?
I wouldn't be so critical if it didn't mean a lot to me. That's the first part of it. And the second part of it is because at the same time that we're critical, one of the things we're working towards, and the first few issues were very negative, because there's a lot of just dead wood to be cleared away. Let's get this straight like that. Is the second thing is that there's tremendous positive stuff going on in every medium that you want to talk about. If you want to talk about Dorothy Love Coates singing progressive gospel, progressive images in her gospel songs, you want to talk about that band Crocus from Switzerland, which does progressive heavy metal lyrics called Eat the Rich, things like that, which is all about how rich people would rather get rich than... and they don't care if you starve as a consequence. That's the reason, is because there's still great stuff out there, and you can find it if you do the work.
Okay, well, I want to thank you a lot for talking with us.
Oh, thanks a lot. This was great.
Thanks for being here.